Welcome, listeners, to Talking Eyes. I'm your host, Leanne Trinh, an optometrist and public health clinician based in Larrakia Country, also known as Darwin in the Northern Territory of Australia. This podcast was created to translate exciting, innovative developments from vision research into a form that both clinicians and really any curious mind can understand. Innovation, simplicity, clarity. This series will be diving into a topic where the research has been absolutely awe-inspiring, the retina. It's just a small part of the human eye, roughly the size of a postage stamp, but it's an incredible piece of human biology that plays a central role in how we experience the world around us. The evolution of stem cell and gene technologies has been a rapidly developing space within my lifetime. And I'm not that old. Each one of these technologies targets vision impairment at different points. Stem cells have the potential to regenerate entire tissue layers, while gene therapy needs existing cells to be somewhat viable so that they can be reprogrammed. Many of you will have heard of the Human Genome Project, that collaborative research program that mapped the human genome back in the 1990s and blew our minds. They completed that sequencing within the decade, and while some scientists worked on mapping the human genetic code, others were tinkering and trying to understand how to change that code, particularly if there were errors causing cells to malfunction. I have with me today Dr. Tom Edwards, who is the head of retinal gene therapy research at the Centre for Eye Research Australia. Dr. Tom's an ophthalmologist with a PhD in medical genetics. And in 2014, he was awarded a Nuffield Medical Fellowship, which meant he could undertake further vitreoretinal surgical training, as well as research under Professor Robert McLaren at the University of Oxford. And there, he worked on a world-first clinical trial of gene therapy to treat a type of inherited retinal disease, choroideremia. Dr. Tom, I'd like to begin with a brief segment on Genetics 101.
The last time I actively learned about genetics was probably biology, first year university, very long time ago. But I do remember that, you know, we have DNA and it's the code that we inherit. And then we pass that on to our offspring as well. And it's made up of segments, genes, which code for specific traits. And you know, everyone's got some sort of variation in their genes, which accounts for our differences. So can you take us through a quick session of Genes for Dummies and how it relates to retinal structure and function?
Yeah, well, you're quite right. I mean, the way I sometimes explain it to patients, and perhaps I might be influenced by my young children, but it's a bit like the Lego instructions for making, a bit of a Lego. Each cell has those instructions inside, well, almost all cells have those instructions inside them. And in fact, the code is highly similar between all humans. And it's just little variations in the way genes are spelt, which account for the variability between one individual and the next. But sometimes those spelling variations can be spelling mistakes. It's not just an American spelling versus an English spelling, for example, where people understand the word. It could be a mistake in the genetic code, which makes the word entirely unintelligible. Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of thing that can happen in the genetic code. And it can be a simple change from one base pair to one base to another, or it can be chunks of the genetic code that are deleted or duplicated. And that can result in the protein that the gene encodes not being either full length or having a change in a critical domain of that protein, which then gives it a different function or takes away its function. And the retina is a very complex part of the human body and seems to be predisposed to genetic changes that affect its function. And so there are a number of genes, up to around 300 or so, that have been discovered that can lead to degenerative changes in the retina. Not all of them result in eventual loss of vision. Some can cause mild changes. Some can you know, people would be familiar with, you know, people who are colorblind, for example. That's sort of on the spectrum of genetic changes that can affect the eye. And so we see the full spectrum of that in our clinics.
Yeah. And then there's now this technique of gene therapy where people, researchers, are looking at correcting the genetic code, these mistakes that you've talked about. Let's talk about gene therapy. How do we correct genetic code?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, the way I sort of think about it is, you know, it's a bit like molecular level surgery.
Tiny.
Yeah, exactly. And so in its simplest form, you can replace the copy that the individual has that's not working properly. And what by that I mean, in its simplest form, perhaps it's just not making enough of the protein or any of it. And in its simplest form, you can just replace that copy that has a spelling change in it in the genetic code with a working copy. And you can do that by delivering it to cells with a virus. And the virus is not, well, the ones that are used in this fashion are not ones that can cause disease. They can't replicate. All you're doing is hijacking their ability to deliver genetic material into a cell. And that's what happens when we get a cold. I mean, that's a cold virus delivering its DNA into your pharynx and throat and nasal passages, and it replicates and gives you symptoms of a cold. Well, I mean, you're just sort of hijacking, if you like, that ability. You think of the virus as like a delivery van delivering the correct copy of the gene. The virus, the viruses that are used are very safe. They have a very proven track record in the eye. And whilst they're not perfect and there are things that could be optimised and improved upon, the general concept is using the virus's natural ability to deliver genetic material into cells. And you can use viruses that have a specific tropism or liking for certain cells, e.g. retinal cells.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So there's been viruses that have been identified that have a natural affinity to certain cells of the body.
Yeah, and they can be manipulated as well. So scientists have manipulated the coating, if you like, on the virus to find that certain changes will make it more specific to the retina or even individual cells in the retina.
Mm.
And so that's its simplest form, just delivering a working copy of a gene. But, of course, there are more complex strategies that have been developed whereby, for example, you can edit the patient's DNA to correct a spelling mistake. Or you can, for example, silence a gene which perhaps is changed in such a way that it is damaging the cell. Mm. So you don't want to give more of the gene. It's more a matter of silencing a unhelpful gene that's been made that way through a spelling mistake. And other strategies in addition to that where, for example, you might have a situation where the photoreceptors, the cells that detect light, have all been damaged to the extent that delivering any genetic material to them would be not helpful because the cells aren't there any longer.
They're not functional.
And so you can deliver genetic material to other retinal cells that don't have the ability to detect light, but their role is to transmit and process the signal that would normally be transmitted to them from the photoreceptors. But with the absence of the photoreceptors, you can deliver genetic material to those other cells that make them light sensitive.
Wow.
Now
that's incredible.
So that's a study that we're going to be doing at the Centre for Eye Research hopefully this year. That's more for people who, as I say, have got quite advanced disease. They've lost their photoreceptors. So there are different strategies depending on the stage of the disease, the type of mutation. So it's exciting times.
That is so exciting. And it's so interesting because I had Lauren in earlier in an introductory episode on the retina, and we were talking about the different cells of the retina, the different retinal layers, and how, you know, historically we were just thinking that these other neuronal cells that connected the photoreceptors to the ganglion cells, pretty much messenger cells passing information from the photoreceptors that had converted that light energy into electrical energy and then moved it on for visual processing. But it's so interesting that now we're talking about you know, other things that they can actually potentially be doing, and things that other roles that they actually play in the retina, not just to act as a messenger or for transmission. So it's so interesting that you're tapping into potential, because retinal cells generally, they don't replicate, do they?
Yeah, like all neuronal cells, they don't replicate, although there's some interesting work being done at CIRA. There are some cells in the retina that are identified and known to have a stem cell-like ability, whereby they can be treated in such a way that they can replicate, and you can influence them to potentially turn into retinal cells that may replace some that have been
which
lost.
Which cells are those?
For example, retinal ganglion cells.
Yeah, right.
So there's work being done there on potentially regenerating some types of retinal cells. It's very early stage, but that's exciting work, not done by our group, but by Ray Wong's group at CIRA.
Okay.
And it's going to require multiple strategies here, because you'll have patients who have got the full spectrum of disease severity, from very mild and to through to severe. You'll have patients of different ages, and also different genes, you know, some of which are very small and can currently fit into the adeno-associated viruses that we're using, but some are too big for the maximum load that virus can take. So for those, I'll need different strategies. I guess it's at the stage now where we're advancing multiple different strategies, and over time we'll realise that certain approaches work best for some patients and others work best for other patients. So, you know, when you've got 300 or so different genes,
so many.
The amount of work that goes into getting a clinical trial up and then seeing it through to
which we'll talk to a little bit later. And just back to gene therapy delivery, apart from viral methods, there are non-viral methods as well,
good point.
There?
Yeah, and it's a similar technology to that which was used in the vaccine that almost all of us had for COVID. So you can use these nanoparticles, which are sort of lipid molecules that will, instead of using the virus, will deliver a genetic payload into cells. They'll be taken up by cells and internalized. And so the genetic material, you know, reaches the same endpoint, but it's delivered in a different fashion. Because, you know, the thing about viruses is that they can, as a vector, they can induce an inflammatory response in the eye, and there are lots of strategies that are developed to minimise that, delivering the tiniest dose possible, for example, delivering it underneath the retina rather than into the centre of the eye. Obviously, in the centre of the eye, it gets diluted, so you need a larger total dose, whereas under the retina, you can have a more concentrated, lower dose. And, you know, giving patients anti-inflammatory drugs around the time of the administration of the drug. So adeno-associated viruses aren't without their issues.
Mm.
And, of course, they've got a maximum capacity. You know, so for those patients who have got inherited retinal diseases caused by larger genes, we need other strategies.
Yeah. I was reading that when gene therapy was being developed, that the eye was actually identified as a really great site for trials to begin on. Can we talk to that?
Yeah. Well, the eyes, we're lucky in ophthalmology that is the case. The eye is unique in that sense because, well, for one, you can see the retina, the tissue that you are trying to, treat. You can physically see. You just look into the back of the eye, you can see. There's no other part of the body that's quite like that. We've got a whole suite of approaches to measuring outcomes, many of which are still not good enough, and we're working on that, trying to find new ways of detecting and measuring the effect of gene therapy. But still, we have a vast suite of functional outcomes,
measuring visual acuity,
sensitivity of the retina, peripheral vision, all the different ways of measuring acuity.
Yeah.
And then, of course, all the different photography techniques that we have, scans
incredible.
That can be done. So it's conducive in that sense. And then it also has this immune privileged status. So any scenario where you might induce an inflammatory or immune response is generally localized to the eye and won't spread beyond that. So you can generally treat the eye with these viral vectors without a risk of them spreading or causing a problem outside of the eye.
Gene therapy, obviously, logically, is being developed for inherited retinal diseases. But there, I guess there are other conditions that gene therapy could be really useful for as well, which are being investigated. It's such an exciting area of research and development, and we have proof of concept as well. We have one treatment that's been FDA approved, Luxturna. So our reality right now is that at least one IRD, inherited retinal disease, where people could possibly have become really vision impaired at an early age, we can actually prevent that from occurring now. Can we talk about the condition that Luxturna was developed to treat? So Leber yep. congenital amaurosis.
Yeah.
And the genetic defect in RPE65,
yeah.
the gene?
Yeah, that's the gene. It was identified as an attractive target in the 90s by Gene Bennett and Al McGuire in the US. They had a naturally occurring canine model, a Biard dog. It's a type of breed of dog that had that mutation just naturally. So it was a nice model for them, an animal model for them to use. The gene fits inside of an adeno-associated virus. It's not too big. It's inherited in a recessive fashion, which generally means you have to, you'll have a situation where you just haven't got enough of the gene. So, like I said earlier, all you have to do is try and add a working copy of that gene into those cells, and theoretically, that should then, you know, get cells going again.
So, when you say the gene's not too big, it's the mutation,
The physical length of
the physical length of the actual gene.
Yeah, you have to deliver a full length copy that's of the correct sequence. Okay. With a virus. And so if the gene's a really big gene, like it's a long gene, like the gene in Usher syndrome, for example, Usher 2A, it's quite a long gene. It wouldn't fit into AAV2, into an AAV vector. So it was an attractive target, I guess is what you'd say. And it causes Leber congenital amaurosis, which is really just a catch-all sort of diagnosis for early onset RP when you've got a more severe phenotype and there's a known number of genes that can cause that.
So it's essentially affecting kids.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So that's been the first gene therapy to go through that whole pipeline, through to FDA approval, TGA approval. Mm. It's approved in Europe as well, and we've treated a few patients at the Eye and Ear Hospital with good results. Mm. And it's exciting times, and hopefully that will be the first of several to come on the market, really.
Yeah. So those patients that you've treated, how old were they and what was their level of vision impairment?
Yeah, we did two sort of 4 to 5 year old kids within
wow,
the space
so really
of a couple
kids.
Of months last year. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they've done tremendously well. It's their low light vision, which is affected first off because it's the rod photoreceptors that tend to get affected primarily parents were noticing the children running around in the dark with much more confidence. They've sent us videos of them, you know, before sort of really struggling in low light and then just walking through confidently after treatment, making better eye contact with their parents. This general behaviour, their confidence running around the house. You know, I mean, it's difficult to test vision in a five-year-old. Mm. You're looking at a lot of feedback and interaction with the parents and what they are observing. And, some of the best ways to do that is just with your iPhone or, you know, mobile phone to take a bit of video. And some of those have been pretty impressive. Mm. Yeah.
That must be so awesome to see after you've provided that treatment to people.
Yeah.
It's an inherited retinal disease. So does that mean that the parents or anyone else in the family were affected? Would they be then suitable for treatment?
Yeah, well, with RPE65, it's inherited recessively. So the parents are both carriers. So they've got one, you know, everyone has two copies of DNA, one that you get from your mother and one from your father. And so in a recessive disease, you have to have the copy with the spelling mistake on it from your mum and from your dad.
Yep.
But they'll have one good copy and one bad copy, and that's what you would call a carrier. In a recessive disease, they would be asymptomatic. So it's one of these things that just pops up out of the blue, or seemingly so. So the parents in that setting would be unaffected. But certainly there are dominant inherited retinal diseases for which, you know, more members of the family would be affected, and potentially if there was a treatment available for, would be eligible to have.
And so how were these children identified? Did they have genetic testing?
Well, generally speaking, it's something that the parents will report about that age, a sort of 4 to 5 year old age, or sometimes a bit earlier, and they'll just notice that kids aren't, you know, aren't seeing as well as, you know, what the parent would perhaps expect. And so, for example, the one patient I'm thinking of that we treated last year was seen at the Royal Children's Hospital by a colleague of mine who is a paediatric ophthalmologist who also is an expert in inherited retinal diseases. And so he was straight onto it. Yeah. And then, you know, genetic testing was performed, which identified the gene. And I mean, it was good news in a way, but because sometimes you don't identify the gene. You know, 30% of cases we just don't find the gene. And so not only was it one that we could find, but it was RPE65 for which there's now treatment.
Mm. So let's unpack genetic testing, because what does that involve for a person who undertakes genetic testing?
Yeah, I mean, the practicalities of it are quite straightforward. You just need some cells from the patient. So you can either get that from a blood sample, from the white blood cells that are taken from that blood sample, or even just from swabbing the inside of your cheek. You can just scrape off some squamous cells from the inside of your cheek, and that gets sent off to a laboratory that usually takes around 3 months to do the testing, and they'll send a report back to the doctor or the geneticist who ordered the test, the ophthalmologist or the geneticist who ordered the test. And as I say, it's around 65-70% of the time we'll get a clear-cut result. Sometimes it's not clear-cut, and, you know, it may be that there's a spelling change, but it's not obvious as to whether or not that change is an actual mistake as such that would cause a problem for that gene, mm-hmm. or whether it's just a natural sort of variation, because we're still, and there are databases and registries which you can look up, and obviously the people who curate the data look those up.
Mm.
But they're not complete, and we're learning more and more all the time. And so sometimes it's one of those types of variants of uncertain significance, or indeed sometimes it comes back blank and we haven't able to determine any error. And oftentimes that can be repeated. You know, 5 years from now we'll know more genes, we'll have more information, and it's possible that would turn up a positive result at that point.
Yeah, and it would have been such an exciting thing for the parents to learn that there was a potential treatment for
condition. I mean, it's a tough time for the parents. I mean, I think
but certainly,
I mean, you know, to be told that there's actually a treatment, whereas in the past, you know, it was just, you know, there's nothing.
Well, this is that's dilemma that we've faced for so long, that so many of these inherited retinal diseases have no treatment at all.
Yeah.
And that, you know, you sort of just have to let people know really gently that over the next decade, 2 decades, 3 decades, their vision will slowly become more and more impaired, which is really hard to digest for the person, because when you first tell them, often they really still are functioning quite well, their vision's still very much intact. It's really hard for them to visualise.
Yeah, I mean, everyone handles that news differently. Mm. It's a tough conversation to have. You know, I got pulled up actually when I was giving a talk one time by someone who had an inherited retinal disease, and they said, well, look, you know, some people were totally fine with it.
Mm.
You know, you don't assume that we're all sort of desperate for some form of treatment. I mean, obviously many are, but don't necessarily assume that this is something that many of us haven't learned to deal with.
Yeah.
So I took home that as a sort of a caveat to, you know, my attitude towards patients with inherited retinal diseases. They're all individuals and coping with that diagnosis in different ways, mm. and it's important to kind of spend the time to get to the bottom of exactly where they're at.
Yes.
But there's no doubt, I mean, when you've got someone sat in front of you who had no idea that that's what was going on, that's a tough conversation, and there's no easy ways around that.
And then treatment. Back to Luxturna.
Yeah.
What does that involve? Like when you're treating a child, do they have to go under general anaesthetic for the delivery? General anaesthetic the usual?
For an adult, not necessarily, but for any kind of eye operation, to be honest, actually in a child who's 4 or 5 years old or even up to sort of teenagers or even young adults sometimes.
If you want it to be a successful surgery.
Yeah. Well, it's very, people have a real thing about their eyes, even being touched quite naturally. Evolutionarily, we don't want things coming near our eyes.
Yeah.
So the prospect of having an operation on your eyes is a pretty daunting one,
let
alone
an injection.
Eye. Yeah, exactly. Mm. Or an eye that's already, I suppose, vulnerable. But the surgery involves techniques that are actually sort of fairly familiar to us. Injecting things under the retina is not unique to gene therapy. We do it on occasions for people at the other end of the spectrum, an older cohort of people with macular degeneration who sometimes have bleeds under the retina, and blood under the retina is a problem for the retina. So there is a procedure where you try and displace that blood by injecting a medication underneath the retina, not gene therapy in this setting, but the actual practicalities of the technique are very similar.
Yeah.
But the needle that you use to inject underneath the retina, so it passes through the retina, is about as fine as a human hair.
Wow.
And it's very, very fine. So although it makes a hole in the retina, you can't even see it afterwards.
Yes. Right. Wow.
Yeah.
And so the child or the person is lying there under local or general anaesthetic. Mm. What happens to them after the surgery? Like, does it take a couple of minutes for you? Is this what we're talking about?
The surgery takes about half an hour. Yeah, it takes about half an hour.
Yeah.
And you only do one eye at a time. And that's a general sort of approach.
Is there like a 24-hour leeway or something between each eye? Is there? Or?
Well, it's a relatively wide window, but we felt that sort of a couple of weeks is about optimal because it gives that first week to sort of recover the first eye, regroup. Sometimes patients are flown into state, so you don't want to have too big a gap.
Mm.
We often put an air bubble inside the eye at the end of eye surgery, so you can't fly with an air bubble in your eye.
Right.
So you sort of wait for that to clear, for the bubble to leave the eye, and then get on and do the other eye.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so you've injected Luxturna, the patient wakes up. How do they feel?
Well, I mean, if they're a young child, they want to get that pad off their eye. So they're sitting up and trying to rip it off and give their eye a good old rub. So that's been something we learnt that, you really need mum or dad there and just trying to
tying their hands back.
Distract the child, yeah. Because you've just done this very delicate surgery, and all the kid wants to do is test out the eye. But aside from that, it's getting some eye drops in to settle down any inflammation stirred up by the surgery. So that can be a bit challenging for young children. Obviously we need a lot of help and support from the parents, which is obviously always forthcoming in spades. But
And is their vision normal after the surgery, or is it distorted?
Well, straight after the surgery, their vision is often poor, particularly if we've had to put a gas bubble in the eye. You can't see very well through an air bubble. But once that's gone, you're sometimes seeing improvements within a month. I'm thinking of the child that we treated last year. It was dramatic. I mean, the orthoptist who tested the vision came in and said, look what they did. This was so much better than what they performed last time. I mean, again, it's tricky with young children to objectively record their vision. So often we're looking at videos, as I said earlier, and that's a really good way to assess their functional vision.
Yeah, because are you delivering Luxturna, so subretinally at the macula, or are you doing it in lots of different locations? Because how does the drug work?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, you're injecting it near the macula. You've got to be careful when you're injecting underneath the retina. It can put some strain on the retina. So you want to start the subretinal injection a little bit away from the macula. Once you get it going, you're then relying on the little blister of fluid. It's like a little mini retinal detachment that you're creating, allowing that the virus to then sort of propagate that zone a little closer and into the macula. The extent to which it spreads to involve the whole retina, because the blister of subretinal fluid is by no means the whole area of the retina, is not really known, because you can't, at least in humans, you can't put like a little fluorescent tag on it, or you can't actually know exactly how peripheral that virus has spread, but we do know it does spread out beyond the little blister of subretinal gene therapy that you finish with at the end of injecting the gene therapy.
And once it's injected, it remains in these cells. Are we expecting for life, for the life of those cells?
Yeah, theoretically, it forms a little episome in cytosol, in the nucleus, and that stays there permanently.
Because these cells just don't die, hopefully, and they don't replicate either. And so you mentioned that the vision in this child a month later was better than before the treatment.
Yep.
So it's not really a vision preservation type of treatment, but potentially vision enhancing type of treatment.
Yeah, well, it depends a bit on the gene. It depends on the stage of the disease. So if you've got cells that are still present, you know, they haven't been lost yet, but are just dysfunctional as a result of the genetic change, then those cells may receive a boost from the working copy of the gene that's introduced into the cells. So in that context, you might get a boost in vision. There may be a gene, for example, that it's not damaging cells. It just stops the visual cycle from working, and causes a sort of more stationary scenario. So in that situation, you might not see necessarily stopping further degeneration, because that's not so much the case. Mm. All you'd be doing there is restarting the visual cycle. So it sort of depends a bit on the underlying function of the gene and how damaging it is when it's been taken out by the genetic change. At the very least, what you're looking for is a cessation or a halt to further degeneration, and and this might lead on to what we were talking about earlier. That's where the challenge in measuring outcome measures are, because the diseases generally progress very slowly. So if your intervention has really affected just a halt or an extreme slowing of the degeneration, which was actually progressing very slowly anyway, and you're doing a study to try and measure that, it may take 5 years before you start to see that, the treated eyes and the untreated eyes sort of separate enough to say, oh, that was a statistically significant intervention.
Yes.
When you've got, people wanting to know the outcomes, pressure's on, come on, we've got to do the next trial, there's all this money involved in setting up these trials. What we're looking for is earlier outcome measures, so we're not having to run the trials for so long. Are there effects that we're missing because our outcome measures are too coarse or non-specific?
Some of you may have heard of the Foundation Fighting Blindness, the FFB. It's a foundation that was established in 1971 by a man named Gordon Gunn and his wife Lily. Gordon was blind from retinitis pigmentosa at just 3 years of age. And in his adult life, he went on to form this group with passionate, like-minded families who were driven to finding treatments and cures for inherited retinal diseases that were affecting themselves and their loved ones. Now, the genetic mutation RPE65 was discovered in about 1993, and millions of dollars was poured from Gordon's foundation into advancing gene therapy research through clinical trials. Luxturna, the treatment, was approved in 2017. So from discovery in 93 to approval in 2017, well, that's a really long time. So Tom, let's talk through the process of trials, the different phases, how you get regulatory approval, and how soon can medicine access these interventions to change the visual trajectory of people living with these conditions. So Luxturna was approved by the FDA in 2017. It's taken a really long time, and that's generally the feedback that I get from people affected by inherited retinal diseases, is why is it taking so long?
Yeah, well, I mean, Luxturna, because it was the first, it was always going to be the slowest. It is a novel. It wasn't the only gene therapy. In fact, gene therapy had a big setback, of course. There was a systemically administered gene therapy that was part of a trial for a systemic disease which resulted in the death of one of the participants. So gene therapy was really set back there I think it was in the late 90s.
Yeah. But
fortunately, the field did move forwards, and ophthalmology has been sort of leading the way because the eye is so conducive to gene therapy.
To really local.
Exactly, localised treatment. Yep. We can see the retina. But there's a huge amount of work that goes into just getting the proof of concept ready for the possibility of a clinical trial, and then the process then begins of looking for investors, to invest in that. So you'll start with cells in a dish. Now we're lucky these days we can make retinal cells from patients who have inherited retinal diseases. So you can get some skin cells, for example, or some blood cells from a patient with the disease that you're investigating. And from that, make retinal cells that can be grown in a dish, and you can do treatment on those cells.
Differentiate existing skin cells into ganglion cells, for example, or
Into retinal cells,
photoreceptors.
So that's all possible, and that's a useful thing to do. You can also,
and is that done because you're turning on and off particular genes, or
So you can turn a skin cell into a pluripotent stem cell, and then again put the right cocktail of molecules on that cell and form it to then differentiate into a retinal pigment epithelial cell or cells of the retina.
That's amazing.
So you're looking at models like that, and then eventually you're getting into a situation where you're like, okay, we've got good evidence that this treatment will work, but we don't really know until we deliver it into humans in a phase one trial. So phase one trials, there's three phases generally. Generally three. So phase one is when you're looking more at safety.
Yep.
You're not too concerned. It's not designed to assess efficacy. Then phase two is looking at.
But you sort of have an idea that.
You have an idea.
Potentially could work. Looking.
And then phase two is more set up for assessing outcome measures and what is the best way to measure the efficacy. And again, you might see early signal there. And then phase three is, all right, this is the one that we're going to take to the FDA or the TGA to say this works or not, as the case may be.
Yeah.
And, of course, when you're transitioning from stuff you've done in the lab to actually then going to a human, it's a massive increase in cost because the virus that you're making has to be made in a special facility that's got all the checks and balances and approvals to make this to the highest possible standard and quality. And that's millions and millions of dollars beyond what you would be able to fund with a grant.
Is that because there's not that many?
There's not that many of these facilities around. I mean, the cost will come down, but at the moment, because there's, I suppose it's a supply and demand issue.
Yeah. Do we have that sort of facility in Australia?
We do. Yep. Yeah. There's a new facility in Sydney, actually.
Okay. Great.
So that's good. The cost of running these clinical trials is massive. And one of the problems we've had, and this is what's caused some trials not make it right through to the end of a phase three trial, is that the outcome measures we're using are perhaps too coarse or too ambitious. When you're just looking to put the brakes on a disease that does progress quite slowly, and not necessarily see a boost in vision, and yet your primary outcome measure is to see a gain of three or more letters.
Mm.
That study's going to fail, even though the treatment may have worked or may have shown signal of efficacy had you waited perhaps longer or used more tailored or specific outcome measure assessments.
And people are really looking for functional change, aren't they? Like, you can't sort of proxy necessarily different biological processes that are happening. And I'm thinking of macular degeneration. Being super slowly progressive, taking a long time for vision loss potentially to occur. And so treatments that you might instigate at the early or intermediate stages might not actually see that effect for a really long time.
Yeah. I mean, any disease that progresses slowly is difficult to
design a study for.
Yeah. Particularly when the only outcome you've got is vision. Like, for example, glaucoma, we know eye pressure is the main modifiable risk factor. And if you're able to just lower the pressure, then you're in good shape. Mm. And if it then takes some time to record a slowing of the progression, well, that's fine because you know the pressure's gone down. Whereas in gene therapy, you don't get that instant feedback of some effect, if you like, when really all you've got is a structure and function. And because those things are changing so slowly, that that's been one of the issues, I suppose, with the design of the clinical trials and one of the reasons it takes longer. But, you know, that said, we're still very optimistic. There's you know, a large number of clinical trials running at the moment, some of which are targeting more common inherited retinal diseases like RPGR, which is the commonest cause of X-linked RP. And in fact, we'll be conducting that one of those RPGR studies here in Melbourne later this year, we hope.
Well, that brings me to my next part of the episode, which is the clinical trials. What have we got, like a top 10, you know, based on the prevalence of the condition in our local community? Do we know the prevalences?
Oh, it's a really good question. I'm slightly embarrassed to say that we don't really have an accurate knowledge of exactly what the prevalence is. I mean, not just in Australia, but worldwide. I mean, the various estimates, and often we'll be quoting sort of around 1 in 3 to 4,000 people affected by an inherited retinal disease.
It's hard when, you know, genetic testing isn't something that's routinely done for people, because that's the definitive, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. That's part of the problem. And, you know, we're trying to address that by creating registries of inherited retinal diseases. So we have one here, the Venture Registry, it's called, at New Melbourne and CIRA. There's other registries in other states as well. And indeed, we hook up with collaborators, you know, in other centres around the world and in our geographic region. But yeah, knowing the exact prevalence, you know, is something that we're working on. But we know which genes are more common than others of that group who have genetic diagnosis. And the one I mentioned just now, RPGR, is a very common one. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of the problem. A lot of the inherited retinal diseases look the same. When you look into the back of the eye, you couldn't necessarily tell that that's this gene or that gene. So you need to have done the genetic testing before you can then give someone a genetic diagnosis and determine whether they might be eligible for this trial or that. But I'd put RPGR as a top sort of 10 contender.
Mm-hmm.
What else have we got coming online? I mean, choroideremia is another inherited retinal disease that's had a lot of attention. It was sadly one of the victims of that outcome measure, overly ambitious outcome measure in one of the clinical trials that was sort of going through to a phase 3, didn't make its primary outcome measure and has somewhat been sidelined.
That outcome measure, that has to be sort of reported before the trial
happens.
Yeah, that's
right. Yeah, yeah.
And it has to be to a certain standard, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Is there like a universal standard where people sort of say, It will only be FDA approved if it meets this.
Yeah, that's right. And so there's a lot of there are working groups working with the FDA and other authorities to, you know, come up with better outcome measures that can be used to assess these trials.
Yeah.
I don't want to rattle off too many genes because there are a number which are in clinical trials. CEP290 is one. PRPF31 is another.
So are there ones which we might see emerging treatments for in the next 5 to 10 years?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, well, there'll be a number. Yeah. I would say there'd be a number.
Yeah.
You know, it may be that you have another sort of half dozen to a dozen coming on in that time. And, of course, there are gene agnostic approaches which are also being developed, neuroprotective strategies with antioxidants, for example, which will be good for patients for whom the genetic diagnosis wasn't made, or for those for whatever reason it's not appropriate to do gene therapy. So all these strategies will be knitted together, and it may be that any one individual actually has, you know, depending on the stage of their disease, may have one treatment for a period of time, then they transition to another treatment, and or they're done simultaneously, for example, neuroprotection on top of a gene specific treatment.
So it sounds like it's actually quite important for people to sign up to these registries if they want to stay informed.
Exactly. That's what I say. I say, look, if at the very least, just put your name on the registry. All we do is give you a call and say, look, there's this research opportunity coming up. Is it something you're interested in? And they can say, fantastic, great. Where do I sign? Or tell me more. Or actually, you know what, I'm not interested. It's a good way of just keeping up to date. And indeed, it's good for us to keep up to date. Sometimes we have participants calling us up and saying, oh, have you seen this or that? And so it works both ways.
Yeah. And so if people do agree to participate in a clinical trial, can you sort of give us some idea of what people might expect, because there must be anxieties associated with even thinking of signing up to a clinical trial.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially, you're a research guinea pig. So if I think if we can convey as much information today about it, it might alleviate some of those anxieties.
Well, look, the big thing to point out is that research doesn't happen without participants. I mean, clinical trial research doesn't happen without participants, and we are acutely aware of that. So we are just incredibly grateful for the time and the effort and the enthusiasm for all our that all our participants show in signing up for these clinical trials. So that's one thing. So that comes through in how we like to, or the standard that we hold ourselves to in terms of how we interact and treat those participants. I mean, they really sort of get the VIP treatment. You know, much as you'd say any patient should get that, but you know, when you're really, in particular, in a clinical trial that involves an operation, you know, it's not just, I mean, some treatments are you know, for inherited disease are just a tablet, but we're talking about gene therapy here where it's an operation on your eye, and those patients really, you know, they're just so generous in every way.
That this is the way that you repay them. So for anyone who hasn't flown first class before, sign yourself up to a clinical trial by the sounds of it.
Well, you know, it's not just the intervention, but they get regular checks after the intervention. So there are checks in the lead up to allow us to really get to know the eye, whether it meets the criteria that are set out, so that the clinical trial is comparing apples with apples and not to a disparate population, so they're as similar as possible. And then if you then at that point sort of meet those inclusion criteria and you're invited onto the study, then generally there'll be some either a surgical intervention, which is generally a sort of a one-off event, or, you know, maybe that it's a different type of study and that you're taking a tablet. But then for the duration of the study, which may be 2 to 3 years, you're coming in regularly, sometimes more frequently, sometimes, you know, more than once a month, particularly if it's an operation that you've had, and then often then sort of spreading out to some slightly longer interval, perhaps, you know, every couple of months. So you're in and out a lot.
Yeah.
You know, so
people really have to have the time.
You've got to have the time.
Commitment.
Yep. You know, if it's a teenager or something like that, and they've got to fit that in around school, you know, that's an issue as well. So they've got to get the whole family, you know, on board. But, you know, I think we're a fun group to hang out with. Patients, you know, usually are similarly enthusiastic, and because that's just the type of person that clinical trials will often select for. And people are really wanting to give back. They're thinking about their own family members or others or just the community at large. And they've just got that attitude of wanting to give back.
Mm.
And, you know, it's important to understand that clinical trials are being done because we don't know if the treatment works. And so you really have to go into it with the understanding
we theorize that it does, though. Like,
yeah,
you know,
course,
these clinical trials, they're not just anything that's been given, not just any intervention.
But nonetheless, it's, you know,
you've
got to manage the expectation, because patients who are really, you know, saying, well, look, this really has to work. You know, I want to be able to see you again, and I'm really putting all my eggs in one basket. You've got to... You know, you've got to manage the expectation there, as do we, to make sure that, you know, it's not a situation where, you know, we're setting ourselves up for failure if, you know, the product turns out to not be as effective as we hoped it would be.
Yeah, and that's absolutely a potential scenario. Look, I mentioned in our macular degeneration episode that clinicians who encounter patients with a trajectory of probably irreversible vision loss where there's no approved treatment like macular degeneration or inherited retinal diseases should immediately be thinking about referring to a centre for clinical trials. And it doesn't mean that you're signing people up, but referring people actually gives them the opportunity to do something, whether it's for the greater good of research, of humankind, or to have a potentially life-changing moment for themselves. Tom, thanks so much for joining us today. It's such a fascinating area of research, and really all these potentially life-changing therapies that are starting to emerge for the treatment of previously unavoidable blindness is just so awesome. It's so, so fantastic. So thanks for all the work that you do, and thanks for joining us today. Thanks for listening to Talking Eyes. Additional resources for this episode can be found in the show notes. If you found the content of our podcast interesting, feel free to post a great review and share it with your community. If you have a topic you'd like to hear more about,
or have expertise in the field of vision and would like to contribute to future series, contact me via our socials on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Leanne Trinh, your host of Talking Eyes.